Thank you very much, Marjorie, and thank you for inviting me again, and to everybody for coming. It is true, I have a cold of some kind, and I've been dealing with it for a month now, so... Nonetheless, there's a microphone, so that should make things easier, I suppose. Our topic for this morning is Hanukkah's competing concepts of beauty. Anyone here read Greek? No Greek readers? So that means I can tell you whatever I want for what that first word says, right? I could say that says hitter versus football, and, you know, like, okay. Now, the word there in Greek is kalos. Usually rendered in English letters as K-A-L-L-O-S, but that's a lot, you know, duller than writing it in the Greek letters. So I wrote it in Greek instead. But kalos is the Greek word for beauty. Hidur is not kalos, obviously. Hidur is a Hebrew word, and it means beauty. Hidur is a Hebrew word for beauty. It has other meanings as well. But hidur is beauty, kalos is beauty. But they're actually different ideas. And that's what I want to talk about, in particular, the way that they are expressed in the story of Hanukkah and in the way that Jews have celebrated Hanukkah ever since. So I want to start with a question. Can you define beauty? Not by giving examples of something that is beautiful, but can you define what it means for something to be beautiful? Yes?
Shining from within.
Shining from within. Okay, that's a deep one. Why would I say that beauty means something that is shining from within?
It's radiant.
Radiant, has a feeling about it. Interesting, you know, we have this, we have a midrash which says that when Moshe was born, the room was filled with light. When Moses was born, the room was filled with light. One of my kids came home last week before from school, having just learned that. And they said, well, it doesn't say that in the verse. What it says in the verse is, Vatera oto kitohu. She, his mother, Yocheved, saw that he was good. So, how does that translate to the room being filled with light? So I asked her, when it describes Moses in his birth, it says, she saw that he was good. How could you look at a baby and see, this baby is good? All babies are good. What does that mean? You could say she listened and heard that he was good, because he wasn't crying a lot. Right? Maybe that. But how do you see that he was good? That is what's bothering the rabbis on one level. Second, the words that are used in Hebrew, ki tov, are first used in the Torah to describe light. God creates light on the first day, and God sees ki tov, that it is good. So the same phrase was used for light as is used when he's born. And then third, not to be forgotten, when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, we're told that his face shone with light, radiated light. So that combined gives us this idea that he's filled with light. The reason I mention it is because you just took beauty and said beauty is associated with radiating light, much as the rabbis, when they see that Moses is described as being good as a baby, automatically jump to, granted the evidence that I just gave, but they jump to the idea of light. So there is this association of beauty with light, with radiance. I definitely hear that. There was a hand over here. Yes?
I think beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
So in other words, we don't need to define it. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, the suggestion was. That whoever looks and decides determines that which is beautiful. Okay, but that's cheating. I'd like to come up with some kind of definition that we can work with. Yes?
Pleasing to the eye.
Pleasing to the eye. A third suggestion. Beauty is that which is pleasing to the eye. Pleasing in the sense that we enjoy it, I assume. It creates good feeling in those who look at it. Okay, that's a reasonable explanation. I think certainly it goes well with the idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because we are made happy by different things. We are pleased by different things. So that makes sense. Let's take these ideas for a moment. right? What we have already so far. I think we could probably go on longer with it, but you know, our session is up to an hour, so we need to manage our time. Beauty is radiant. Beauty is that which people personally find appealing in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is that which is pleasing, perhaps. Is it a Jewish value? I hear no's. Why not?
I think it's character that's important.
Character, right? You're familiar with Pirkei Avot? Right? Pirkei Avot says, Al tistakel b'kankan ela b'ma sheyesh bo. Don't look at the bottle, look at what's inside. The bottle does not necessarily indicate the quality of that which is inside, although it helps. But the statement is that we're not supposed to focus on externals. Okay, that's one view. Yes?
We're also told to beautify Shabbat, the Sukkah, all our Shabbat's table. We're told to beautify.
Excellent. We are told that we are supposed to beautify our mitzvot. Right? There's a biblical verse in the Song at the Sea, Az Yashir, in which the Jews turn to God and they say, Zeh Keli, this is my God. Good title for a book. This is my God. Ve'anvehu. Which admits multiple meanings, but one meaning, and as it's understood by the sages, is, and I will beautify him. And the Talmud says that means hitna elefanav b'mitzvot. You should beautify yourself before him when you practice mitzvot, so that you make a beautiful sukkah, you have a beautiful lulav, you have a beautiful talis, you have a beautiful whatever it is, whatever your mitzvah item is, the Shabbat table certainly, we try to make it beautiful. Absolutely. So on the one hand, we're told the externals don't really matter. And I think that's a solid bedrock idea within Judaism. That's not a small idea. We're going to see verses to that effect soon. But on the other hand, we do value it when practice the mitzvot. Yes?
Isn't the shape supposed to hide the beauty? Nowadays, it doesn't.
That's a really good question. We have nothing else to talk about for the next hour now. Isn't the shezel, okay, the shezel, the wig, meant to hide beauty? So that's actually, that's actually quite a good question. Because you may notice if you travel in populations where people have the sheitel, quite often the sheitel is much more beautiful than the regular hair. So is that really its goal? And the answer is not necessarily. Right, no, and there is such a school of thought. But the dominant school of thought seems to be that it's much more about the privacy of the relationship. And saying that this about me is personal, and therefore it's only for my relationship with my husband. Whether you like the idea, don't like the idea, isn't the point. But that seems to be the driving philosophy. And so it's about concealing that, and a person can still be beautiful without. Having said that, there is a notion in both the dress of men and women, traditionally, of saying, I don't want to be eye-catching. Right? The idea of tzniut, of privacy, says that I shouldn't dress in a way that's going to grab people's attention. So, you know, that's something that does figure into this, I think, on the whole. Yes?
Was the shameful not brought in because the women were being raped in Russia and the mother, therefore the wife wouldn't be appealing to
the I must admit that's a new idea to me, but given that the laws of Shezel go back more than 2,500 years, but there was no Russia. It's true that there have always been. I mean, biblically, there were people who were attacking women pre-flood. So that has always existed. But I've never heard the explanation that was meant to protect women from attackers. That's one that would require research. I haven't heard the idea before. Yes?
I thought it was when there were lords or whatever, the lord had the right of the first night when anybody got married. Yes, he is, but he protected. So to her. So when the young Jewish woman got married, the lord could have...
Right, so the shekel wasn't going to prevent that.
So she shaved the head so that it wouldn't be appealing.
Oh, interesting also, but mixed. We're talking about apples and oranges. It is true that existed going back to Roman times, and in fact, The Talmud records that there was a historic practice that Jews had of getting married specifically on Wednesdays. Wednesdays are associated with certain blessings. Biblically, Wednesdays had certain conveniences within the community as well, but they stopped doing it because it allowed the Romans to predict when Jewish weddings would be and take advantage. So there was such a phenomenon, and it affected how Jews practiced. However, once again, first of all, the shekel doesn't require a shaving of the head. That's a practice that you find in certain Hasidic circles much later than Roman times. But second, I don't think they're associated. But I'm going to go back to the beauty concept. As much fun as it is to talk about shekels, I'm not so... let's leave it at that. We have indeed competing indications as to whether beauty is a Jewish value or not. Take a look at your sheet, please. Take a look at source number one. From the book of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1. This story occurs when Samuel comes to anoint a king. And all of the sons of the household are brought out before him. And this is the house of David. So, when they came, it's all of David's brothers. David is not brought out before him. That's a story in and of itself. But when they came, when the brothers come out, because the prophet is there and he wants to see all of the sons, he saw Eliab, who's the oldest. And he said, God's anointed one is before him. This is it. This is the one who should be the king. Apparently, he was very impressed. God said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance and height, for I have rejected him. It is not as man sees it. Man sees to the eyes. God sees to the heart. Elokim yirele inayim, Hashem yirele levav. God is the one who sees what's really there. Is that an acceptance of beauty or a rejection of beauty?
Rejection.
Rejection. I think it's fairly clear. Take a look at source number two. Classic verse from the book of Mishlei, Proverbs. Right? This is likely familiar. Right? The Hebrew goes, Sheker ha'chein ve'hevel ha'yofi isha yirat Hashem hitzit halal. From the poem Eshet Chayil. Right? Usually translated as woman of strength or woman of valor. Right? Okay. Who wrote it, by the way? Who wrote the poem? So, if you look at the book itself, the book of Proverbs is credited to Shlomo HaMelech, to King Solomon. That these were proverbs that he taught, and over the generations were, by the time of King Chizkiah, a successor generations later, they were collected and recorded as Solomon's proverbs. However, this part of chapter 31 is likely authored not by Solomon, but by his mother. Because the chapter begins saying this is the rebuke that his mother gave him. And the chapter begins with a message to him of, don't go chasing after drink, and don't go chasing after women. And then, a woman of valor who can find, and so on, and she describes the ideal woman that he should find as a wife. Which has tremendous irony, because in his book of Ecclesiastes, that he writes towards the end of his life, he says, I never found it. He says, he tried. And Talmudic teaching says he married 1,000 women based on a verse that he has in Ecclesiastes. And he never is able to find someone who will fit the model that his mother presented him, which says an awful lot. And there's way more that we're going to get to right now in that one. The story of Bathsheba, his mother, is a complicated one that requires exploration. But the model she sets before him seems to be built on his great-grandmother. Solomon's great-grandmother is a woman named Ruth. I say that because some of the descriptions of the Eshet Chayil fit Ruth, but also because there's only one woman in Tanakh who actually is called in Tanakh, in Scripture, an Eshet Chayil, a woman of valor, and that woman is Ruth. So it seems fairly clear that what's going on is Bathsheba is saying to her son Solomon, who's this great king, with all the power and with all the wisdom and with all the money, she says to him, you want to find a wife who's going to be like your great-grandmother. You want to find a wife who's going to be like Ruth. And so she lays out for him this beautiful description. And here is the penultimate line of that description. She says, "Charm is false, beauty is empty. A woman who is in awe of God is to be praised." Once again, don't get caught up in beauty. Don't get caught up in that which is pleasing to the eye. Seems like a negative. And then on the other hand, take a look at source number 3, please. Source number 3 is a passage in the Talmud. I could have brought you biblical verses to support it as well, but this I felt encapsulated things in an eye-catching way, so to speak. Rabbi in the Talmud says, people compared to Sarah, when you compare people to the beauty of Sarah, as in Abraham and Sarah, are as a monkey compared to a person. Meaning, human beings compared to Sarah are like they're not even human when you compare them to her beauty. Her beauty is such that she makes people look like they're not even people. Now, nobody in the Talmud has seen Sarah. Right? There's a gap there of, you know, a couple of thousand years. Not a couple of thousand, that's an exaggeration, but enough time. There's certainly a long gap between Sarah and the Talmud. So they didn't see her. All they know is that she's described biblically as being beautiful. So how do I know that she's that beautiful? Hold the question. Sarah compared it to Eve. Okay, Eve, Adam and Eve, is as a monkey compared to a person. So as great as Sarah is, Eve is way above her. Eve compared to Adam, I apologize, is as a monkey compared to a person. And then Adam before God is as a monkey compared to a person. What in the world are they talking about? They've lost me. Where's beauty? Physical beauty for God? We're taught that God doesn't have a body. So clearly we're not talking about physical beauty when we put God on the scale. The whole thing is very strange. What is this talking about?
Nobody compares to God.
Well, I could have said that in a much shorter form and not running the monkeys. Poor monkeys. So what's going on in this?
Why is he talking necessarily about beauty? He could be talking about intellect or soul or any number of things.
Right. So, excuse me. The context for this comedic passage makes clear they are talking beauty. But it also makes clear that what we're talking about here is not so much about beauty as perfection. And the idea is that Sarah is head and shoulders above everybody else in her greatness. But Eve, formed by God, is necessarily going to be more perfect because it's God's handiwork. Now, I know there's a classic line that says that, you know, Eve is the one God makes to correct all the mistakes in Adam. I get it. However, the view here is Adam is the more direct handiwork. Because he creates Adam and then he slices off part of Adam and creates Eve out of that. So therefore Adam would be as closer to God's intent, would therefore be more perfect, again, like it or not. And then Adam is still nothing compared to God. But my point is not to start, you know, a battle about Adam versus Eve. Nobody wins that one. My point is that they choose to manifest this statement about perfection through beauty. And they do. Yeah, it's not as clear when I've been just this line, but it's much more clear within the context in the Talmud, that what they're doing is they're saying the one who is more perfect is more beautiful. And so we in fact find the matriarchs biblically are all described as being of great beauty. Leah, there's some debate, her eyes were soft. Not so, the description biblically of Leah is unclear. But as a general rule, Rachel is described as being of beauty. Our matriarchs in general are described as being of beauty. Queen Esther is described as being of beauty. There's a Talmudic discussion about that as well. So we need a deeper understanding of what beauty means within Judaism, as well as within Greek thought, through the prism of Hanukkah. So let's see what we can do here. We'll turn our attention to the Greeks for a moment. People often say that the Greeks romanticized the body, and that they saw beauty as being physical, And that Jews, on the other hand, see beauty as being spiritual. I've heard people make that statement. But realistically, it's not true. It is true that the Greeks venerated the physical form, right? We have all the statues that testify to that. We had the Olympics where people competed without clothing on. The point was to demonstrate the beauty of the body. But the Greeks also spoke of virtue. They spoke of music. They spoke of mathematical perfection. And they used the term beauty regarding all of those. They didn't have this narrow idea that beauty is the model you see in the commercial on television. Beauty is the actor or the actress. Their description of beauty was broader than that. You can't pigeonhole the Greeks into saying beauty is physical and material and mundane and this world and nothing else. That's number one. Number two, you can't pigeonhole the Jews into saying that beauty is spiritual. First of all, we just mentioned the apparent language of physical beauty regarding the matriarchs, but particularly for Hanukkah. If you take a look at source number four, a passage in the Talmud. It's talking about the menorah, the seven-branched candelabra that you had in the temple, which had been made useless, rendered useless, by the Greeks in their invasion. Every time I say Greeks, you know that they're technically Syro-Greeks, historically. They weren't coming from Greece to invade. They were actually, you know, Syrians who were under the Greek Empire. But I say Greeks because it's shorter. They're not here to answer me anyway. But if you take a look at source number four, the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, post the Greek domination, seek to create a new menorah. Well, the menorah, as it's described biblically, is supposed to be made of gold. They're not, as rebels who just, you know, fought off the Greeks, they're not in a position to create a menorah of gold. So what do they do? The branches of their menorah were iron rods, and the Hashmonaim coated them with tin. They felt it would look better. When they became wealthier, they made the branches of silver. When they became still wealthier, they made the branches of gold. You know, each time, of course, somebody dedicated it, they just put a new plaque over the old plaque. Now, they beautify the menorah. How do they see beautification of the menorah? By making it of a more beautiful physical material. They believe they are elevating it by using gold. There are other examples of this. If you take a look at source number five, Masechet Sofrim is a text that was added to the Talmud. It's old, about 1900 years old. And it presents a law regarding our Chanukiah, what we light on Hanukkah. And the law, it says, is one may not light an old lamp. Sorry about that. One may not light an old lamp. One who only has an old lamp may whiten it well in fire, and that is permitted. What they're talking about is a lamp made of clay. And the concern is that a lamp made out of clay, after years of use, develops a lot of buildup from the oil. Remember, they're using oil. From the oil and its grease, and from the wick, and from being singed, and it doesn't look nice. So they say, that's all you have, refire it. Right, expose it to a fire, and that will clean it up somewhat, and that's permitted. Their emphasis is on the physical beauty of what you're doing. Jews are into the physical as well. There's a lot of discussion about the oil, also using proper oil. In fact, we consider it something to pursue. Take a look at source number six. You may be familiar with this. The Talmud has a discussion about how many lights we light on our Chanukiah. Right? On the fifth night of Hanukkah, how many lights do we light? Did I say sixth night or fifth night? So if the fifth night, we're lighting five. Why six? The shamash that you use to light the others. Okay, I wasn't counting the shamash because it's not part of them. But okay, that's fair. We're lighting according to the number of nights. That's not the basic mitzvah. The basic mitzvah is to light how many? One. The basic mitzvah is to light one. You know, before I come to Toronto, I lived in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is Pennsylvania Dutch country. And on the first night of Hanukkah, it was beautiful because the whole city, everybody had one candle lit in the windows of their home, Jews and non-Jews. They had the practice of lighting one candle every night. So theirs wasn't on a Hanukkah. But, and they didn't necessarily know they were participating in celebrating Hanukkah. It's kind of my joke on there. But take a look at source number 6. The mitzvah of Hanukkah is for each family to light one lamp. One lamp, one flame, that's it. Those who beautify light one lamp for each individual. Each person in the house will light one flame. According to Beit Shammai, the school of Shammai, major rabbinic school, first century Common Era, those who beautify still more light 8 lamps on the first day, and then reduce by 1 per day. So they go backwards. Start with 8, and then count down. And the Talmud discusses why. It's a long story. According to Beit Hillel, they light one lamp on the first day and then increase by 1 per day, which is what we are familiar with. So, all is not lost. Our practice is in there too. By the way, they were before the Common Era, I realize. First century before the Common Era. Okay. But here, we have the idea of adding candles. The word in Hebrew that's used is lehader, which sounds like the word I used before, hidur. So the question is, what does lehader mean? Take a look at source number 7, commentary on the Talmud written in the 13th century. It appears to Rabbeinu Yitzchak, a rabbi of the time, that the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, who say you do number of candles per the night, whether you're going up or going down, refer only to the candle per household approach, so that this would provide greater beauty. Tosafot has a problem. He has an interesting problem. He says, look, I have a household with 6 people in it. If we're all going to light according to the number of nights, so let's say it's the third night, we're going to have 18 candles. No one looking at the house is going to know it's the third night of Hanukkah. Right? When they look in my window, or as it used to be, and it still is in some parts of the world, when they light outdoors, try that in Toronto, when they lit outdoors, people would look and they'd have no idea what night of Hanukkah is. You've defeated your purpose. Your point is to show it's the third night, but you have 18 candles. So he says, this must be that when they say you light according to the night, they mean, and there's one menorah for the entire household, and that way it's obvious to the onlooker. Of course, we can also solve the problem by putting our menorahs in different places, at different windows. Our houses don't look like their houses. It's a lot easier for us to manage this problem. My point wasn't that. My point was that he understands that the purpose of doing this is to provide greater beauty. That's how he understands it. Rashi, on the other hand, writing slightly earlier, took it slightly differently. He said the word hidur doesn't necessarily mean beauty. Lehader is to go after something, to try to acquire something, to try to gain something. And so he says it's about pursuing. He says in source number 8, those who pursue mitzvot use one lamp each night for each member of the household. It's about pursuing something. It's beautiful not because it's physically beautiful. It's beautiful because you show that you're doing something extra for it, that you want to do something in a better way. Okay. So what's the difference then between the Jewish and Greek perspectives? If you're telling me that the Greeks believe in beauty that is both physical and non-physical, and the Jews believe in beauty that is physical and non-physical, notwithstanding Rashi about beauty being that which you pursue, which we may come back to, what's the difference between Jewish and Greek perspectives? So the answer lies in that Greek word that I introduced in the beginning called kalos. The Greek, I'm going to explain the concept of kalos and then we'll see an actual quote from Greek thought on it. But let me explain it outside first. Anybody here read the writer Neal Stephenson? Sorry. He's very good, and he happens to have used it in a book of his that I felt really conveyed it very well. When I think of traits of something, its color, its size, its shape, I tend to think of those as adjectives, right? They are descriptions of the item. If I say that the shirt is purple, if I say that the banister is brown, or the banister is a cylinder, or whatever, I am describing properties of the item. It's an adjective. Fine. But to Plato, Plato who preceded Hanukkah by more than a century, these properties are actually examples of an entity that exists as a pure form in another world. That sounds very strange. Let me explain it. It will still sound strange, but at least it will be a little more clear. Somewhere in his mind, in Plato's mind, there is a perfect triangle. Perfect beyond anything that will be manifest in this world. When I see something that has three sides and I call it a triangle, it is a reflection of that triangle that exists over in that other world where the perfect triangle exists. When you describe something as being solid, there is a perfect state of solidity in that other world. When I describe something as being green, there's a perfect shade of green somewhere in that other world. Nothing in this world can be what exists in that other world. This is a world of physicality, and it can only reflect what exists in that other world. It's a basic Greek concept. And beauty is the greatest of these forms. There is perfect beauty in that other world. Can't exist here, but it exists there. And that which achieves the perfect state is itself beautiful. The more close you come, not just physically, but in virtue or in any trait, the closer you come to perfection in this world, the more beautiful you are. That was the Greek concept called kalos. Beauty is not radiance. Beauty is not what pleases somebody, except beauty is that which is perfect, and therefore it will please you. That's the idea that the Greeks put about. Take a look at source number 9. It's a very, very difficult idea to wrap your mind around, at least for me. Maybe for everybody here it's easy. But look at Plato's work Phaedrus in source number 9. There, in that realm, abides the very being with which true knowledge is concerned. A reality which is colorless, formless, intangible, visible only to the mind, the pilot of the soul. She beholds justice and temperance and gains knowledge absolute, not that which is found in varying forms in one or other of those regions of becoming which we men call real, but real knowledge, really present where true being is. Because I've read that probably 50 times, I have a sense of what he's saying. But it takes a lot of repetition for it to get into our skulls. But what he's trying to say is that what our minds, our souls, can comprehend is something you can't see here, something you can't touch here, something you can't find here. But it is this absolute which he's going to call beauty in this other realm. Take a look at source number 10 on the second slide, please. He describes how people become different, how people are earmarked to be, to play different roles in this world. Why there are people who are philosophers, which in the mind of Plato is a great thing to be, and why there are people who are athletes, and why there are people who are doctors, and why there are people who are artists. Look at what he says. The soul which has seen most of truth in that other world shall be placed in the seed from which a philosopher or lover of beauty and follower of the muses will spring. If your soul perceived beauty before coming into this world, then you're going to be a philosopher. Or one of these traits, one of these roles. That which has seen truth in the second degree shall be some righteous king or warrior chief, be a leader. The soul which is of the third rank shall be a politician or business manager or trader. The fourth shall be a lover of gymnastic toils, an athlete, or a physician. Okay. The fifth shall lead the life of a prophet or seer. Why is he on the fifth rung is a good question. You have to know more Plato. To the sixth, the character of a poet or some other imitative artist will be assigned. To the seventh, the life of an artisan or husbandman. I'm not actually sure what that is. I assume it'd be a farmer, but I don't know. Husbandry, that's what I was thinking. Okay. To the eighth, that of a sophist or a demagogue. to the ninth, that of a tyrant. All these levels are states of probation in which he who does righteously improves, and he who does unrighteously deteriorates his lot. These are the states that you enter into by default in this world, and then you can improve or you can drop based on what you accomplish. Source 11 is, I think, the most important expression of the idea. He's describing the state of a person in this world. He says, when he, the human being, sees any earthly beauty, he is transported with the recollection of the true beauty. He would like to fly away, but he cannot. He is like a bird fluttering and looking upward and careless of the world below, and he is therefore thought to be mad. And I have shown this of all inspirations to be the noblest and highest and the offspring of the highest, that it is recognized to be such by him who has or shares in it, meaning this pursuit of the beautiful, to be infatuated with the beautiful. And that he who loves the beautiful is called a lover because he partakes of it. For as has been already said, every soul of man has in the way of nature beheld the true being. This was the condition of her passing into the form of man. When the soul entered into this world, it had to have some perception of beauty first. And it has a recollection of it. And when it sees something that evokes that beauty, it wants to run after it. And the more sensitive it is, the more strongly it is smitten by that beauty. But all souls do not easily recall the things of the other world. They may have seen them for a short time only, or they may have been unfortunate in their earthly lot, and having had their hearts turned to unrighteousness through some corrupting influence, we're still in Source 11, they may have lost the memory of the holy things which once they saw. Only a few retain an adequate remembrance of them. And they, when they behold here any image of that other world, are rapt with amazement. But they are ignorant of what this rapture means, because they do not clearly perceive it for what it is. For there is no radiance in our earthly copies of justice or temperance or those other things which are precious to souls. They are seen through a glass dimly. And there are few who, going to the images, behold in them the realities, and these do it only with difficulty. What he is saying is, not everyone remembers what true beauty is, but those who remember it are so struck by it when they see it that they must have it and they must pursue it. And those are the people who are of greater refinement, he says. And I conclude this part of it with source number 12 from Plato's Symposium. Only in the contemplation of beauty is human life worth living. Strong, no? Very strong. That is the Greek concept of beauty. Not about the body versus the soul. You perceived beauty in a previous existence as a soul, and the more you perceived, the greater your level is in this world, and when you see it here, you long for that pristine version of what he would probably call something like heaven. Only in contemplation of beauty is human life worth living. Our concept of beauty, on the other hand, is as an adjective rather than a noun. We beautify something if it is worthy of being beautified. How do you say honor in Hebrew? Kavod, very good. Is kavod a good thing or a bad thing? Depends if you have it. Is kavod a good thing or a bad thing? I hear good and I hear bad. Why is it bad? No, no one said bad. Okay, why is it good? Sorry? Right. But is kavod, is honor, is that a good thing? So, if we take it as respect, then yes, it's good, but really, whether kavod is good or bad depends on who it's for.
What if it's for the parents?
That's an example for the parents. We have a concept of kibud av ve'em, honoring one's parents. We have a concept of kavod ha-Torah, honoring the Torah. Right? We rise when the Torah is out, that sort of thing. We have a concept of kavod ha-meit, right? Honoring the body when somebody passes away, taking care of it properly, with respect, and so on. Kavod for others is good. Kavod taken for ourselves, on the other hand, is bad. Lesson in Pirkei Avot, Hakid'ah v'ta'ava v'hakavod, motzi'inet ha'adam in ha'olam. Jealousy, desire, and pursuit of honor remove a person from this world. They take a person out of this world. If a person is looking for it for themselves, then kavod is bad. The same thing is true for beauty. We beautify something that is worth being beautified. We beautify a mitzvah, examples that were given before. They beautified the menorah. We do it not so that people will pursue the beauty itself. We do it so that people will pursue the mitzvah that is being beautified. Go back to Rashi's point about pursuing something. So going back to our initial question, the question of how Judaism feels about beauty. To the Greek, beauty is a goal with its own value. We should try to become as perfect as possible in whatever field of endeavor it is. Objects should be crafted to be as beautiful as they can be. The human form should be developed to be as perfect as it can be. Music should be designed so that it will achieve perfection in its scales and its form and so on. Mathematical formulae can be said to be beautiful if they are perfect. And in each field, Greek thinkers developed the concept of what beauty meant. To the Jew, beauty is a means to honoring that which we value. It's not about beauty, it's about the way we use it. Beauty that deludes somebody about a person's character is bad. Eliab, being handsome, impresses Samuel, and God says to him, don't be impressed. Right? Beauty that's going to impress Solomon and make him say, oh, maybe I should marry her. His mother says, don't get drawn in. Right? Beauty that deludes is corrupting. But, on the other hand, beauty that glorifies that which deserves to be glorified, such as in the case of the matriarchs who are described as beautiful biblically, that's wonderful. And now that brings us to Hanukkah and the way we celebrate Hanukkah. When each of our holidays celebrates defeat of an enemy, the theme is shown in the celebration. Not all of our holidays celebrate a victory over some enemy. But let's take Pesach, right? Pesach celebrates victory over the Egyptians who had enslaved us. And on Pesach, every year, in the times of the temple, even a little bit after the temple, they would slaughter the Korban Pesach, the Pesach offering. They would take a lamb. Why they use a lamb? Because the cow is too big? No. Different answer. That wasn't my line. I heard that over here. Sorry. It's kind of beautiful. Why are we killing it?
Korban has to be perfect
for God. Maybe, except that we actually eat this. This one isn't for God. It becomes a meal. Everybody eats it. So, it's funny. I mean, parts of it go on the altar. That's true, but it's fundamentally a meal. The choice of lamb is understood by many commentators as being because the Egyptians worshipped the lamb. Lamb worship wasn't their only god, but there was lamb worship in Egypt. And because there was lamb worship, the Jews were making a statement of, we have defeated the Egyptian god, we reject the Egyptian idolatry, we are now servants of our god, and we are getting out of this country. That was the message. And so every year, the Jews would celebrate Pesach by once again defeating the Egyptian god, saying we reject that system, long after the Egyptians and their god were gone. That's Pesach. Take another example, Purim. What are the mitzvot of Purim? I know it's far away still, but what are the mitzvot of Purim? Reading the Megillah. What else? Mishlach manot. Sending gifts of food to others. What else? There are two others.
Giving to the poor.
Giving to the poor. Matanot la'aniyim. Good. And the fourth is? Close. Su'udah. Having a mishneh, having a feast. Right? Having a feast, which, yes, often involves drinking. The four mitzvot of Purim are obviously meant to evoke the story of Purim initially. We read the Megillah, and the story in the Megillah revolves a lot around feasts and parties from the beginning all the way to the fall of Haman and beyond. But it's also about unity. You give gifts of food to each other. You give money to the needy. You invite people in and make a feast. It's about a collective celebration. Because how did we get in trouble in the first place on Purim? What was it? What was Haman's claim against the Jews? That's what got him angry when Mordechai wouldn't bow to him. But what did he say to Ahasuerus? Yeshno am echad mefuzaru beforad bein ha'amim. There's this nation that is all scattered and divided among the nations. That's his opening point. The Jews are scattered and divided. We celebrate Purim by again defeating that enemy, in that case the division, by bringing people together for the celebration. Hanukkah, the defeat is of the Greeks. The Greeks who took beauty and said that should be your main pursuit, only in beauty. And remember, again, Plato is just a century before these events. They're familiar with Plato's thought. He is the thinker. Only in the contemplation of beauty is human life worth living. And so when the Jews want to create their celebrations for Hanukkah, they specifically combat this Greek idea of beauty and say, we're going to co-opt it for ourselves. We are going to beautify, not ourselves, our property, we're going to beautify divine service to show how we use beauty. And so we're going to beautify our mitzvah by adding and adding, and we're not just going to light one candle, we're going to light for, you know, every night, we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We are going to beautify our menorah. We're going to use something that's clean and fresh and new. We're going to beautify the menorah in the temple. And so they start with the iron, that's all they can afford, and then they work their way up as they're able to have more. That is the beauty of Hanukkah. To sum up, what we've said is that the difference between Jewish and Greek conceptions of beauty isn't theirs is physical and mundane and ours is spiritual and holy. It's not so. The idea of beauty that they celebrate is one that views beauty as a value in and of itself, manifest on whatever in whatever way it's going to be manifest. And we view beauty as a means of showing honor to that which is worthy of being honored, such as the mitzvah. And that comes through in our Hanukkah celebration. And I would add one last thought. Beautifying our mitzvot, whether for Hanukkah or all year long, helps us a great deal in terms of our continuity as a Jewish people. Someone once asked me, well, I'll leave out the part that someone asked me. Leave that. There is a tendency, unfortunately, in the Jewish world to try to ensure continuity by warning our children of what they must not do. Right? Don't go there. Don't become friends with that girl, because she's not Jewish. Don't read that. Don't watch that. Don't whatever it is. And to my mind, if you're working with negatives, you're in trouble. It's much more about creating a Judaism which our children will look at and say, we want that for ourselves. We want to replicate that. If children look at their parents' world and see that the parents aren't having a good time, that the parents are doing it because they have to, that things are just done by rote to get them done, and that's that, then frankly, they'll look at it and say, tell me exactly why I want to consign myself to a life like that. Like, why should that be a part of my life? I live in a world in which I have every choice. I can do whatever I like. You know, it's not the world of 50, 100, 200 years ago. So, to my mind, making sure that the mitzvot are beautiful, making sure that we are invested in them, energetic about them, enthusiastic about them, and that it's something that our children and grandchildren are able to witness so that they see a mitzvah as more than just an obligation, I think that has a much stronger chance of guaranteeing that it will go on. Mind you, there are no guarantees. Because ultimately, kids are their own people, and you can do everything perfectly, and they will still decide to do whatever they want to do. And that's life. And no one should ever be judged for what their children decide to do. That's silly. But you do want to do the best you can. And you want to provide the best odds that you can. And to my mind, the value of beauty is not only in showing how we work with beauty versus how the Greeks did. And not only about celebrating Hanukkah, but ultimately about creating a Judaism that our children will want to perpetuate. Thank you very much.